Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. New York had a pretty up and down week. Crude has slid down from its high, but it was enough to briefly push the Canuck buck over 80 cents. Rick Ackerman, publisher of rickspicks.com, tells us the U.S. dollar is on the rise, and he explains why that's bad news for most of the world. He comments on inflation, the bond market, and President Biden's war against Canadian energy. Checking in from San Diego, realestatetiming.com newsletter publisher Robert Campbell tells us what inflation is doing to U.S. real estate and why the U.S. dollar is doing so well. Plus, at the end of the show, we'll have a company showcase update from American Manganese CEO and President Larry Ray. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Welcome back to the show, Ross.
Good to be back with you, Jim.
How did our stock exchanges do in the past week?
Pick a day. This was one of those weeks where I started well, had a hiccup in the middle of the week, and came back a little bit at the tail end. So, you know, what you've had is a pretty good low if you look back at it at the beginning of March. Very oversold, so one of the, you know, the best possible rallies that we've seen in probably about 2 years here into the early part of this week. Got overbought, there's no question about that. And we've been seeing this transition still, as we've talked about, between the value stocks and the growth stocks. And value at this point had to come back pretty well. We had the S&P probably retrace the better part of 70% of the decline that it had from the highs, whereas you've got the NASDAQ, and in particular things like the ARK innovation stocks, they are still just a mile off the top. Good percentage move off the bottom, but probably still within a fairly significant downtrend, and I think that you can be looking to still sell into the strength into the these high, the old high flyers that we had in the growth group. And I think for the next maybe month or so, you can be a buyer of the blue chips, the S&P 500 or the Dow, on any maybe 25 to 30% corrections off of that March low. So upside bias, as I say, for the stronger stocks with the dividends and the decent earnings. Wouldn't be at all surprised that you actually put in a new high as far as those ones are concerned.
Crude oil remaining sky high?
Clearly topped out back, 3.5 weeks ago now at that $130 level. That was a really good exhaustion high for us as far as our indicators are concerned. And this is continuing to really track that 10-year model that I look at, so that we were looking for a major high in here, and at $130 we got the types of readings you'd expect. The first thing that you would get out of that is a big 50% correction, which is what we had. From 130, you corrected back down to about $94. And then we had a 50% corrective rally back up again. So we're into this thrashing phase in here right now. And what you'd expect to see here is that the support is sitting just under $100, call it maybe around 97-ish right now. If it's unable to hold that 97, then this is going to look like a bit of a distribution pattern. and you probably end up with a target down in the low 80s. That might be then a good long-term purchase, but for right now, anybody who's fairly nimble, I think you want to make sure that you're not risking it if we get that close below 97.
The Canadian dollar, has it finally gotten over the 80-cent mark with these high oil prices?
You know, it had that initial surge through 80, just managed to poke its head out to about 80 and a half, but just doesn't have the power behind it that it looked like, 2 weeks ago when the oil market was still in reasonable shape. The Canadian was showing some life to it. Oddly enough, even with the strong agricultural commodities that we've seen now as well, the corn and the wheat, the Canadian hasn't done all that well. So there's looks as though there's going to be some trouble still getting through, I'd say, the 80 and a half range. But think of it as a trading range, 77 and a half to 80 and a half, and probably too early to say that there's a major trade to be had on the upside there.
How is our friend gold doing?
Reacting similarly to what we've seen as far as the oil market is concerned. When you get times of conflict internationally, you will typically, and when we go back, you're going to get a big spurt in terms of the prices because everybody looks for a safe haven. You go all the way back to the Iraq-Iran war, you go back to the Falklands. It's all of these events cause a big surge in buying. And that pent-up enthusiasm from the speculators then has to be unwound as the tension eases. And not that, things in the Ukraine have stopped at this point, but they're no longer at that threshold level that we were seeing a couple of weeks ago. And so what you historically need to see is a clean out of that speculative fever that was in there. We keep an eye on the relative strength index, and usually it takes the better part of 4 to 6 weeks off the high before the relative strength gets down into an oversold category, and that becomes a good buying opportunity. So at this point, we've had two small sell-offs from the high, enough to be interesting, but not enough to think that the bottom is in as of yet. Wouldn't be at all surprised that we give up another, $50 to $100 before they put in a good attractive low. The one thing it is of note right now is that the miners, you look at the GDX, the GDXJ, they've been holding up exceptionally well. So, maybe once we've got this consolidation out of the way and get rid of the excesses, there might be some pretty good potential on the upside.
Ross, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Always nice to be back with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. You can find him on Twitter at chartsbyross. Coming up, Rick Ackerman next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks. His website, rickackerman.com. He's speaking to us from South Florida. Welcome back to This Week in Money, Rick.
Always a pleasure, Jim. I appreciate your inviting me on.
Rick, the U.S. dollar seems to be quite strong right now, despite so many people predicting its demise. What's the story behind the U.S. dollar right now?
Isn't it amazing? If someone had told you 2 years ago that we'd have this insane inflation, that price of everything would be going up, you'd think the dollar would be going down, but it's not. And I think we're increasingly seeing a squeeze on dollars. They're available for certain purposes. certainly to inflate stock equity assets, but a dollar out of control is a very dangerous thing. You know, the Fed has managed interest rates and inflated asset values to keep the economy from collapsing into deflation, but the dollar is still the elephant in the room. It's too big to control.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were saying for the rest of the world, high value U.S. dollar is a disaster. Can you explain?
Yeah, it's the last thing in the world anybody wants, really, because anybody who owes dollars, which means everybody on the planet, even people who use other currencies, they're subject to the burden of paying back those debts with dollars that have been repriced upward. So a strong dollar effectively increases the burden of debt in real terms. And you know, we've got a lot of markets that are sort of booby-trapped to work only when the dollar is relatively stable. But an increasing dollar puts a lot of pressure on some of these crazy markets, like the derivatives market. That's a big crazy market that aggregates to a notional value exceeding $2 quadrillion. So this is something I talk about a lot because it's just so obvious. You can't really escape the fact that the big casino financial game in this world that essentially plays off that $2 quadrillion plus market is more than 10 times the size of what we actually trade in goods and services. So it's pretty easy to tell what the real business of planet Earth is.
Mm-hmm. Now, we always keep hearing, will the Chinese yuan be the world's next reserve currency, or even the Russian ruble? What do you think their chances are of bumping off the U.S. buck?
Eventually, yes, but I'll tell you, you don't want to know what's going to happen between then and now. It's not going to happen as a matter of policy. It's not like, and China, I don't think it has any real goal to, it's not pushing the idea that the yuan should be a global reserve currency. Nobody really wants that. Everybody talks about it like it's the mantle of respectability, but it's really just a burden for most countries, and they, I think, are just content to let the dollar take all the pressures of this huge, very highly leveraged global market in financial instruments. So China will get there slowly but surely, especially to the extent that it feels like China honors the tradition of gold. They're not saying, well, we're going to move to a gold standard. But I think there's a pretty good consensus in China at the official level, but also at the private level, that good, strong money is a good thing. So, you know, the U.S. sort of lost sight of that 30 years ago, but strong money, I think, will come back at some point.
Canada and the U.K. have sold off all their official gold holdings. The U.S. has gold in Fort Knox, or does it? Because the last audit of Fort Knox was back in the early 1950s.
Yeah, there is that the question of whether the gold is actually there. And I guess just as the dollar will eventually give way to some other form of money, the question of whether the gold is there is going to come out in the process.
The Dow, do you think it's going to go higher, or have we peaked out and we're due for a major crash?
I think we're in a broad topping process right now, and you know, I wouldn't rule out the possibility of one insane thrust to new highs, and I track Apple very closely because I think that if you get Apple right, you get the market right. So it didn't quite do what I was expecting. In fact, Apple got into, on the daily chart of Apple, the recent peak there up around 180 was squarely in a discomfort zone that I would typically be shorting. But I still expect new all-time highs in Apple, which means the market itself has not made an all-time high.
The NASDAQ, which focuses on high tech, is it going to wobble, you think, before the Dow does? I mean, it has been a little bit.
Yeah, it's more than wobbled. I mean, it took a real hit there when someone got the genius idea that these FANG stocks in particular were overpriced. So I guess the consensus of chimpanzees who manage money shifted back into quote-unquote value stocks, if there were such a thing in this day and age. So some of the high flyers have underperformed over the last several months, and I wouldn't give them up for dead yet, though. I do think we've got one last run up, but I'm also watching for the top. To the extent that I'm sitting here waiting for new all-time highs, I would hate to be fooled by a bear market that begins. Well, I guess you could say it already has begun. So I'm open to that possibility. And as a technical question, I try to get a handle on that just by looking at the corrective downtrends. I use just simple ABCD patterns to predict targets, and good healthy bull markets, when they do their ABCD thing, they typically reach their D targets, but on the corrections, ABC coming down, they don't quite get to the D targets. So when you see that happening on the very lesser charts, it's your clue. When small pattern, even on the hourly chart, start exceeding their corrective D targets, it means that the other trend, the dominant bull market trend, is weakening or perhaps even expired.
Inflation around the planet is running rampant, except I think in Guyana or something where it's still 2%. But Canada and the U.S., the government always likes to underplay the amount of inflation that's out there because they don't want to pay pensioners what they're really due. But what's your take on inflation right now?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I'm a Social Security recipient. When I see that the check goes up, I mean, when's the last time that happened? Anything, but I guess I'm in that category that actually benefits from the inflation adjustment. Not too terribly much. In fact, I think it got eaten up by the increase that came for Medicare. But any case, we're in pretty deep now, and I don't think there's. I keep saying that the big juggernaut sort of sitting out there is deflationary, but you wonder how high can prices go. Gasoline prices, for one. Do people stop driving or drive a lot less when they're at $7 or $8 a gallon? So I don't think crude has seen a top either. So you know, we might have another round of price increases at the pump. But so many things. You go shopping for groceries and everybody's substituting cheaper things for. Oh, these dramatically expensive things like meat and eggs. So you really wonder how far it can go because there hasn't been a corresponding increase in incomes. You might say the inflation is feeding off asset inflation. We're all essentially buying groceries with the inflated value of our homes.
Mm-hmm. Now, back in the late 70s, early 80s, I was lucky to work for a radio station that believed in looking after their employees, and every 3 months we got a cost of living bonus. At the time, about $150, which everybody go, woohoo, and I said, no, you know what that realizes is that all our dollars are worth like $150, you know, less. You know, they're just trying to keep us even. And if your boss thinks $150 is enough to make up the difference, then it really isn't. But at least they're trying or giving the appearance. Most of it didn't even bother. And Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau brought in wage and price controls. Well, I'll tell you what, it sure kept wages down. But inflation is international. It did nothing to keep prices down. So government interference when there's inflation can be pretty painful for the victims.
yeah, government interference with wherever the fine hand of government is applied, you're going to have trouble.
Well, I don't know. It doesn't really apply. I think it does. In Neil Young's song "Keep on Rocking in the Free World," one of the lines is "a kinder, gentler machine gun hand." It's still a damn machine gun. Exactly. Now, interest rates are usually touted as the way to bring inflation under control. Are we going to see interest rates skyrocket along with inflation?
And that's just so stupid, really. First of all, we can have a deflationary depression without an increase in interest rates at all. I mean, to talk about adjusting interest rates and putting the damper on inflation, kind of pulling a Volcker, we'll push interest rates up to 20%. Well, we can't do that anymore. I mean, there's so many, the whole system is so leveraged out that if you put any more weight, if you deleverage at all, it starts a process that will be hugely beyond control. So forget about, like, the Fed has its, the quacks at the Fed have their stupid charlatan plan to gradually raise interest rates over time. And the only thing you could say about that so far is that the markets seem not to understand where that will eventually lead. But the steady increases, the system can't absorb that. The system really, when you play it forward, it couldn't even stand a 25 basis point rate hike. So here's the Fed talking about, oh, we're going to just keep raising rates as far as the horizon line. What are full of crap. You know, they're never going to get there before they bring the whole system down, or it won't take anything that the Fed is doing to make that happen. It's just going to happen, as we were talking earlier, with a strengthening dollar that nobody wants, and some other factors.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, I remember 1981, the Canadian government put out 21% Canadian savings bonds. A very nice return, but don't forget your mortgage was at 14, 15%. If you had a 15% mortgage rate now, who could buy those $1.5, $2 million so-called average homes in cities like L.A. or Vancouver or Toronto?
Yeah, a lot of slum neighborhoods in California with million-dollar homes. I mean, we can't. Things really are so pumped that we really can't make that adjustment that the Fed is talking about. We're slowly going to raise rates over a period of time. That's just it's like slowly being squashed by a huge those things that compress automobiles into something like a cube, a small cube. It's that kind of pressure that the system is under.
Yeah. And speaking of those ships, I live on the waterfront in Vancouver, and I see the barges going by with those crushed cars. And it's, and on one hand, interesting, and on the other hand, very sad to see what was somebody's pride and joy that they paid $50,000, $100,000 for, crushed down to some rusty metal.
Yeah, well, that's where we're going.
Now, the bond market, where's that going?
Well, it's kind of stalled out. I actually, if anybody's tuned to my newsletter, I think I caught the top on a 10-year within a hundredth of a percentage point. It stalled at what I call a hidden pivot level, up around, I'm trying to remember what the actual number was. So the 10-year note recently topped at it looks like 2.503%. But some time ago we talked about a higher forecast. I think that the long bond, the 30-year, is going to go to about 3.01 or 0.02%. So we're not quite there, and that kind of relates to the strategy I've been advising, which I call the barbell. This would be gold opposite treasuries, but we're still not there. You gotta like gold because nobody really does except gold bugs, and you gotta like treasuries because there nobody really does. And so treasuries are really taking a hit from all this, this profligate talk about, just from the huge monetization that's been going on. But I still think we're not quite there on the 30-year. 30-year has been as high as, let's see, this was just a couple weeks ago, up around 2.57%. And I think we'll look at it at 2.68%, because that could be where interest rates top. But they will top, and you're going to see a big shift of money into treasuries at some point when everything else looks too scary.
Now, with gold, again, people are saying in troubled times, people run to gold. Are you surprised that the price isn't much higher than it is?
Now, gold's just in kind of I can wait out you guys bull market. We still have the bullion bankers with all their shenanigans crushing gold whenever they need to do that relative to some expiration cycle something that essentially poses the problem of delivery. So the big guys, the bullion bankers, are on a kind of regular cyclical basis knocking gold for a loop. But it's still, the bull market is still there, and if you look at a chart going back to last summer, you just see that we could correct even further. Gold's currently trading basis June contract 1927, but it could come all the way down to 1850, even 1800 without doing any real damage to the uptrend. So gold looks fine, but it's in no hurry to blast off for the moon.
Silver being both a precious and industrial metal, you'd think the prices for silver would be much higher. The story there.
Well, you would think that, and I know someone who buys 1,000-ounce bars of silver, and he stepped up his purchases simply because he was finding it so hard to get his hands on physical gold. Silver. So when you see that, you think, well, the market is really very impacted, but that's not how the market works, really. It's just kind of the big sleazeballs who borrow bullion for nothing, who kind of determine where prices are going, and you have these swings between their shenanigans that sort of keep silver and gold within a range, but a range that keeps shifting higher. So yeah, silver should be, who knows what it should be. I can project up to around $30 here using a ABCD pattern on the daily chart. So you can think, well, it's underpriced, and I guess it is, but it's not what you'd think, really. It's how the market perceives things that determine these crazy valuations.
Crude oil prices have gone crazy the last little while. You'll remember 2 years ago, they were trading in the negative.
Yeah, they got down to, what was it, $6.50 a barrel or something? We should have been out there buying then, I guess. But right now I'm using a 130 target for the NYMEX crude. This is basis the May contract, currently trading 99 and change. So there's pretty good upside remaining there, you know, about a 30% move. I'm watching it, though. I mean, crude has taken a pretty good hit, maybe because, I don't know, the story always changes, but maybe the idea that China's manufacturing sector is looking weak, and of course they're the strongest factor in pricing crude at the margin. They're the swing marginal energy user. So with this somber story coming out of China, I think that's had its effect on crude. So I'm going to be watching. If it takes out, if the May contract takes out 92.20, which is about $7 below where it's trading now, that would be a sign that the bull market in crude has finally been broken.
In Canada, well, they were building the XL Keystone pipeline from the oil awash province of Alberta down to the Gulf Coast to process it. And the very first thing President Biden did when he was elected was cancel the XL project. And now he's begging friendly countries like Venezuela and Iran, and of course I'm saying that facetiously, to pump more oil to bring down gasoline prices in the U.S. The solution was right there on your own soil. How do you feel about that?
Well, it's like everything else that Biden does. It's it's the negative side is always going to be underreported. So it leaves you thinking, well, geez, have I really got this right? Did Biden skew oil higher simply by coming out against the production of oil as kind of his first gesture as president? So you don't read about it much. It's not like the New York Times is going to do editorials that say Biden really screwed everything up by canceling the Canada project, but it certainly set the tone for what's occurred. It's in the back of people's minds, at least people who concern themselves with the ups and downs of oil prices, there's this idea that if the oil exploration climate is favorable, then you can sort of factor that into your long-term view of crude, and it will tend to keep the price down. But the psychological hazard, really, of canceling one project is enough to provide an extra measure of buoyancy to crude, well, ever since Biden canceled that project.
Rick, before you go, anything that's really caught your eye that we should be watching closely?
It's so hard, really, to look at the flux of things going on right now. I mean, ostensibly, I'm in the forecasting business, but we've all got to be pretty confused about the outcome here. There's so many big things happening in this all-too-interesting world that any one of them could destabilize the system in a way that no one will have foreseen. So I'm just in that boat myself. Between all the things that could happen, you know, everything from where the Russian oligarchs are keeping their money and who's trying to interfere with that, to the Ukraine, the geopolitical fallout from Ukraine itself, and of course this huge consumer inflation in the U.S., and a possible earnings recession for U.S. companies and multinationals. So you really can't, it's so hard, you can't model it or even intuitively come to anything that you could be confident about. So I'm not really going to go too far out on a limb, other than to say that I think that the U.S. stock market is in a broad topping process, but we could see possibly see one marginal new high before it tanks.
Mm-hmm. Rick, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Well, it's indeed a pleasure, Jim, and I appreciate your inviting me on.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website, rickackerman.com. He was speaking to us from South Florida.
Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Robert Campbell, author of Timing the Real Estate Market and the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter. You can find him online at realestatetiming.com. He's speaking to us from beautiful San Diego. Bob, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Bob, when's the next issue of the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter coming out?
That will be May 15th, 2022. I publish it every 2 months. The last issue was came out on March 15th, so that was about 2 weeks ago.
Could your book, Timing the Real Estate Market, educate people on life-changing decisions they could be making at this point in the real estate market?
Absolutely. I've identified five key indicators that that sound off alarm bells before any major trend change in the real estate market is coming, whether it's up or down. And if you just follow those five key indicators, you'll be more informed than 99% of all the human population.
Do the stock markets look like they're climbing a so-called wall of worry?
Yes, that's an old familiar phrase, and I would say yes. I mean, but I think it's that I think the reason that it's still holding its own is because that we're having capital flight out of Europe right now into U.S. equities because that we're a safer haven.
What's the latest on California and U.S. real estate?
It's appreciating at the fastest annual rate than in U.S. history, Jim. In California, it's going up anywhere between 15 and 20% a year, which is faster than it did in the during the bubble years from 2000 to 2006. And the United States, it's the same. We've exceeded the old highs by a considerable margin. And it's not only that, but it's the momentum is still up. It's still up. I think on a year-over-year basis, that maybe with one monthly exception or two, that the momentum is getting stronger, not weaker. The only question is we're going to see, of course, you know, I don't like to think about what's going to happen to the markets, you know, into the future because you don't know. But these rising interest rates, it's going to be interesting to see if they cool down the markets.
What's likely the real rate of inflation and what would it need to be done to get it under control?
Well, that is the key question I'd like to focus on in this interview. According to government statistics, CPIU, which includes food and energy, rose at 7.9% in January. I don't think the February figures are out yet. Oh, maybe that was February, but 7.9%. That is ridiculous. My wife edits my real estate timing letter for me. And I had spent quite a bit of time talking about inflation. And year over year, according to government statistics, food prices were up 8.5% or something year over year. My wife's Italian, she shops every day. We have fresh food every day. And she looked at that 8.5. She goes, that's total BS. Total BS. He said, it's at least double and probably triple that. So draw your own conclusions.
Well, also, not just the price, the containers are getting smaller. Here in Canada, milk and cream are sold by the liter. Not anymore. It's now 946.
I know. The best, you know, the real world observation, Jim and everybody else, is the only way to gauge what's going on in the world. We can sit back and talk about, you know, government statistics and all that stuff. You want to know about food prices? Talk to somebody that shops at a supermarket every day. They'll give you the real story.
Yeah, that's 946 milliliters, by the way. So, what are inverted yield curves, and could they be signaling what's ahead?
Inverted yield curve. What an inverted yield curve is in a normal market condition, long-term interest rates are higher than short-term interest rates. When the yield curve gets inverted, short-term interest rates rise above long-term interest rates. And what that signals is that there's a demand for cash that's greater than long-term money. And that's the inversion. And typically what that signals, and it's a very, very reliable signal, is that the U.S. Economy is going into recession. And it's, the key indicator that I watch, I use the three-month T-bill, 90-day T-bill rate, over the 10-year. And if you go back to the last, 10 recessions in the United States, the yield curve has inverted prior to 9 out of 10 of those recessions prior to the recession occurring. So it's an extremely reliable indicator of coming weakness to the U.S. economy.
Could the bond market bubble finally be bursting?
Yes, it could. And it's going to, and I think it's going to burst because of inflation. It's going to burst because of inflation, because back to that topic again, is that that the Federal Reserve Board has pressured interest rates down, and kept them down for, you know, at least, you know, 10 or 20 years. And now we're at the point, we haven't seen inflation like this in 40 years, and now that inflation's roaring, there's only one way to stop inflation. There's only one way. You can dance around the topic all you want, and that's you have to raise interest rates above the rate of inflation. So let's say, even using government totals, which is totally understated, let's say U.S. inflation rate is 8%. What happened during the 1970s, during the Fed chairman Paul Volcker, what he had to do, he had to raise short-term interest rates 6 full percentage points above the rate of inflation to stop it, to contain inflation. So if we use that same formula today, which is probably generally true, that means interest rates are going to rise, you know, anywhere in the range of 6 plus 8 would be 14%. Would that break the bond bubble? It'd crush it. Real dilemma right now, what we're going to do, because the inflation is real, but nobody has the will, to raise interest rates, you know, to stop inflation from destroying the U.S. economy and most of the especially the middle class. So you got one thing here. You know, do you save the markets, real estate, and stocks, or do you save the U.S. economy and the consumer? Ultimately, I think there's only one choice. They're going to be forced to raise interest rates and stop the pain from inflation, and that's going to absolutely destroy the bond market.
Does the Federal Reserve usually play catch up to the interest rates set in the bond market?
Yes, they do. Of course, they do. The only thing the bond market, you know, the Fed can typically control is the short end. But now with quantitative easing, they're controlling the long end too via their purchases of long dated bonds. Like all of a sudden, the government puts out a 30-year bond that would trade at 2.5%. Well, who the hell would buy a 30-year bond at 2.5%? If inflation's at 8, there's only one person, and that's the Federal Reserve Board. So they keep buying this stuff, you know, at these absurdly low levels, and that's what's keeping long-term interest rates down.
But when people say, oh, they can't believe interest rates can go all that high, I remember 1981, the Canadian savings bond paid 21%. And even though I'm was making about $700 a month, I scraped together every penny I could find to buy Canadian savings bonds, and that interest rate paid for my wife's master's degree at the University of British Columbia.
Absolutely. When the rate on a debt instrument is greater than the rate of inflation, then it pays to own it. U.S. Treasury bonds and notes are like gold in the world. You know, there's no chance of default. You know, especially with the printing press, but it's the world reserve currency. Back in that same time period, 1980-81, the 30-year Treasury bond was trading at 17%, Jim.
What's the real estate market showing in momentum and trends?
The trend is up and the momentum is up. That's what's amazing. I'll tell you one thing that is changing, though, and that's the inventory of homes for sale. And it could be a short-term blip, but right now, as of a month or so ago, the number of homes for sale in the United States was at all-time record lows. All-time record lows. Recently, though, the momentum is shifting a little bit. We're more properties coming on the market. That, you know, but it's not a trend changer yet, because, you know, year over year, inventory of homes for sale is still down, you know, depending on the market you're in, but in the U.S., like 15% year over year. So what you have is a shortage of homes for sale, with steady demand, and that's what's pushing housing prices up. Simple supply and demand.
What is the likelihood of a soft landing in the housing markets?
Low, very low. Because one thing, housing markets are very cyclical, and if you go back and study the past to help determine the future, that you can see that this next downturn in housing prices is going to be epic. It's going to be epic. I say that with this consideration, however. If you go back to the 1970s and look at what happened to housing prices in the United States, inflation averaged 9% per year during the 1970s. Housing prices, U.S. housing prices, averaged 9% per year, rose 9% per year during that same period of time. So that's why in my next timing letter, guys, I'm going to be writing U.S. housing prices could double from here. As expensive as they are, they could double from here. You know, I think the median priced home in the United States right now is, let's just call it $400,000. It could go to $800,000. Is it driven by demand? No. It's driven by inflation. So you don't know what's going to happen. So in other words, inflation, real estate was a solid hedge against inflation during the inflationary 70s. You neither won nor lost, you know, on that investment, which is not bad considering what most people do during inflation, However, what I think is going to happen, the big winners during this inflation are going to be commodities and gold.
Is there demand for land away from cities?
Absolutely. In the last 2 years, since the coronavirus hit, the Montana appreciated more than any other state in the country. Second was Idaho. Third was, like, I think, Nevada. So what people are doing, they're leaving the coast and they're going inland. So, I mean, what do you get in Montana? I mean, I don't even know I don't think I've ever been in Montana. All there is wilderness out there. But people are obviously going to those states. Now, that doesn't mean that Montana's expensive. It's always been relatively cheap. But that just means that it was cheap before. It's a lot less cheap now relative to how fast other places are appreciating. So yes, you know, pure statistics, the outlying states that are, you know, the boondocks, if you will, are appreciating faster than the urban areas.
Hmm. I talk about real estate appreciation. I just realized I made 10 times as much on my condo in Burnaby that I bought in 1988 as what I paid for it.
Yep.
Yep. That's what's going on with real estate. Is the buying power and wealth of consumers up against debt and interest rates?
No, it's not. Consumers are still losing ground. Even if you use the lowball government inflation rates, the average consumer is losing ground to inflation, which is very typical.
On the dollar index, the U.S. dollar is in the high 90s. What are your thoughts on the greenback?
Well, the reason that it's still in the high 90s, I mean, is that I think you're seeing capital flight to the United States. So you look at it, if the dollar's up, the euro's down, which is the second biggest currency. The euro's down. So that people are getting out of euros and they're getting into dollars. Interestingly, on a historical basis, gold has moved inversely to the dollar index. Gold is rising, and so is the U.S. dollar. So sometimes these long-term correlations. So I think people are the dollar is still strong, but can that change? Yeah, that can really change. Especially that can change with Putin tomorrow, April 1st. He said he will only accept For the commodity he owns that's very valuable, especially to Europe, oil and gas, he will only accept rubles in exchange. He's not going to take U.S. dollars. U.S. dollars, you can just print those things up, and Putin said, I'm not going to take them in exchange for my valuable commodity. I want rubles. So you could see that the status of the dollar to start to get undermined. I mean, we'll wait and see what that's happening, but Putin's playing a chess game here against Biden. That somebody should remind Biden that you can't print oil. And so all of a sudden, Putin's there with his hand on the valve of gas to Europe. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is how you negotiate to your great benefit. And he has the high cards, and he's playing them. And I don't care whether you like him or not, Putin is a winning poker player, and he's going to win this game.
Could the Russian ruble become the new reserve currency?
No, it couldn't. And the long ago, I read a book by Jim Rickards. I'm a big fan of his. I don't trade off of this information, but he's got an excellent mind and a lot of experience, and so he makes me think. But he talked about one of the nuclear options. If Russia wanted to strengthen the ruble, all they would have to do is back it, let's say, by 40% gold. The whole world would rush to gold, would rush to the ruble, because it's safer than an unbacked currency. The U.S. dollar could come close to collapsing. We would have hyperinflation in the U.S., and you could destroy the U.S. dollar and the U.S. economy. And that some of you readers may or may not know, during the last 10, 20 years, the biggest accumulator of gold has been Russia and China. Now, I know those guys, you know, Russia and China. Why are they accumulating gold? Are they the friendliest countries to the United States? Not even close. In fact, most people consider them enemies. Why are they doing this? Why have they accumulated all of this, quote-unquote, barbaric metal? Because if they wanted to strengthen their currency and have money flow into their currency and out of other currencies, you could see people selling their dollars like crazy to get into the ruble, to get into the yuan, which would drive the U.S. dollar down, which would drive inflation up, and you could see inflation go out of control.
Real estate market psychology. What causes people to buy high, sell low, and what causes them to buy low and sell high?
Oh, that's one of my favorites, guys.
Yeah.
Most people buy real estate, or any other asset for the matter, when they have the money. Here's their timing system, guys. People buy an asset when they have the money, which is typically during good economic times, and they sell it when they need the money, which is during bad economic times. So what people do in general is they buy high and sell low. That's their timing system.
Buying a home versus an investment property, are there different parameters that come into play when looking at the deal?
Absolutely. A home is a place to live, everybody. You either rent a place or you own a place. Now, it depends on your own, how you feel about things. But when you're a renter, the owner's in control. When you own, you're in control. So even if it costs you more money to own than it does to rent, most people will opt for the owning because it's peace of mind. However, now with rental property, like here in California, you know, prior to 5 years ago, or I should say prior to the coronavirus, the individual that owned the property used to be the one in control. Now, it's gone way away from that the person that lives in the property is the one that's in control. In California, you try to raise somebody's rent that lives in a property. They start squawking or kick them out, even for non-payment of rent. That is a hotbed of litigation here in California right now. In other words, the tenant is the one that has the power, not the owner. So on that basis, there's no way in the world would I ever want to own investment real estate in California at this point in time. No way at all, because I'm not in control. I want to be able to control my destiny. And all of a sudden, you got a crappy tenant, or all of a sudden, you got a tenant in there, and they said, I can't pay the rent because I've been impacted by coronavirus. Whether it's true or not, guess what? They don't have to pay the rent. They don't have to pay the rent. So who's going to cover the mortgage? You do. The owner. Those are enormous risks. So that, as with everything in life, whether it's real estate or stocks or, you know, other personal decisions, you always have to be measuring the potential risk versus the potential reward. And as I see it right now, that risk reward is in favor of the tenants and not the owners. So I don't want to own real estate. I'm going to own some other asset class. Particularly now during this inflation, I'm going to own commodities and gold. Which, by the way, everybody, I do. I do eat my own cooking. My Roth IRA right now is 100% in a commodity fund. DBC. It's an ETF. DBC. And that's composed. Here's how it's weighted. 45% energy, 25% agricultural commodities, 12% industrial commodities, and 12% gold. And that adds up to close to 100%. But during the 1970s, why I chose that, I researched it. During the 1970s, commodities averaged more than 30% year rise against inflation. More than 30%. Gold was not far behind. That was just 2 or 3 percentage points lower. And so I'm always a believer the best way to predict the future is study the past. And so that's where my Roth IRA is. You know, I mean, in that, I said, I just went all in. I pushed it in. And I think that's the best route to go. And I've always been interested in an exit strategy. Okay, when this stuff doubles or triples in the next 5 or 10 years, whatever the case may be, that how will you know to get out? And you know when you know to get out? Is when the Federal Reserve raises interest rates at, 4 or 5 or 6%, whatever it takes, above the rate of inflation. All of a sudden, you start looking at moving averages, and you say, that's get ready for the exit. Because the inflation is over. And it's essentially for gold and silver, their time in the sun is over. So whatever you do, guys, whatever you invest in, you have to have an exit strategy when you're going to get out of it. No asset class is good forever other than real estate in Vancouver and Toronto in Canada.
When buying real estate, is allowing for opportunity costs a good idea?
Well, I mean, like right now, real estate in California and let's look at the United States is appreciating at about 19% a year. Inflation is 8. So in other words, you've got an 11% premium right now owning real estate versus some other asset class. So if you own real estate, hang in there. That's still you have an investment. You're getting a 10, 11% real return on your money. U.S. stocks, for example, let's look at this. Let's say in the last 6 months, U.S. stocks are, let's just say they're down on average 10%. 10%. So have you lost 10% of your money? No. You've lost more than that. Why? Because inflation's going off at 8. So add 8% to 10%, the purchasing power of the money you have in stocks right now is down 18% in the last 16 months than it was prior to that. In the last 6 months than it was prior to that. So is there a risk in owning stocks right now? You're damn right there is. If you'd much rather own real estate, I mean, at least for a while until this thing blows up, and then move your money into commodities and gold.
Do people who follow cycles tend to do better with investing?
I would say most people don't follow cycles. But in general, yes, because everything is cyclical. And it's cyclical from the standpoint that markets are driven by human emotions, fear, greed, and hope. And that's why sentiment is so important. That here in the United States, back at the top of the housing bubble in 2005, that in polls, like 70 to 80% of all people said real estate's going to be the best investment going forward, for the next 5 years. And these polls came, I believe they came from Pell or Gallup poll. It's a Gallup poll. Fast forward 6 years, at the bottom of the cycle, when it's obviously the best time to buy, that is real estate a good asset class to own over the next 5 years? Those percentages fell from 70% down to the mid-30s. So in other words, completely, people are always 100% wrong about when to buy and when to sell. This kind of thing. And it's great to be a contrarian, guys. I'm a contrarian. But being a contrarian is not enough. You still need to know when to buy and when to sell. That's why you need indicators to watch, whether it's inverted yield curves, or whether it's how fast the Fed raises rates above the rate of inflation, or the key indicators that, I present in my book, Timing the Real Estate Market. Those are the indicators that are gonna add to your contrarian nature, which, by definition, is usually a good way to invest.
Is a debt bubble likely to make things even worse for the economy and the people?
Yes, it is, because Once we get inflation and they have to raise inflation, raise interest rates, the debt bubble, not only on a national basis, on a country basis with sovereign debt, but individuals, I mean, you know, that own something, that have credit cards, or that, you know, have a variable mortgage on their house, which a lot of people do. All of a sudden, you know, that all of a sudden they got a variable mortgage on their house that's at 4%, and now it goes to 18% when it resets the next year. Those people are going to get screwed. And what's so bad about inflation is not only the debt bubble, everybody. It's what it does to the economy. Back in the 1970s when we had, you know, inflation averaged 9%, we had back-to-back inflations here in the United States in 1980 and 1981. And at that time, they were the worst since the 1930s depression. That's how bad it is. Unemployment went up, I mean, way over 10%. And that's the risk, you guys. It's not only that, you know, what is that going to do to your job? You could lose your job. Or you may be asked to take a pay cut. And, you know, most people are living month to month. Month to month. Way more than 50% of the people are living month to month. There was a poll taken years ago that, you know, 5 years ago, and they said that 52% of all American families cannot pay a $500 emergency bill with cash. They need to put it on their credit card, or they need to ask their parents, you know, go to somebody for a loan. That's how close we are to the edge.
If food and energy prices continue to go higher and higher, will people take money from other expenditures and just focus on food and energy?
Absolutely, and that's what happens during inflation. They reallocate their resources. So the essentials of life are something you can't cut back on. And what are those? Housing costs. You have to live somewhere. Rents in the United States last year, nationally, went up almost 13% a year. 13% a year. Housing is up, you know, almost 20%. So you got to pay for that. You got to pay for energy. You can't live without it. Utility bills. Those bills are going up and up and up. And so you're going to need more money for that. Medical costs are going up and up and up. You got to allocate money for that. And food costs are going up and up and up. So what gives? Here's what gives, guys. The first casualty is eating out. Going to a restaurant. Those guys get crushed during inflationary episodes. Another thing is travel, domestic and international. It gets killed. Interestingly, also, and this makes sense, you think you're more likely that you can barely pay for food and energy? Are you likely to remodel your house? Of course not. So there are all these remodelers, you know, they're going to be in trouble. And that's what gets cut out. Discretionary items get reduced, and because all the money they save from not eating out, not remodeling their house, not going on vacation, does that mean they're saving money in the bank? Uh-uh. No, it's going all into things that are going up with inflation at a rapid rate.
Could life insurance companies be in jeopardy?
I think so. I mean, and that's all a function of what's have it with COVID. I'm seeing statistic after statistic after statistic. And let me just cite you one. The U.S. military. Obviously, they tend statistics and say, you know, what percent of all people in the U.S. military, and these are all young men, you know, die in any given year? What percentage of the force die in any given year? And it's low, 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 low. All of a sudden, in 2021, that number went up from like a low figure to a super high figure. I mean, so what's killing these people? It's obviously, it's not war. It's got to be that vaccine. And so life insurance companies have tens of millions of customers that they guarantee their life on. They can tell you within 50,000 people a year, I would guess, actuarially, how many are going to die in a given year. So let's say they say, yeah, you know, we're going to have 50,000 claims in any given year. Okay, and we have to prepare for that. Okay, now it goes from 50,000 to 500,000. Where's that money going to come from? In fact, I even heard something recently that there's insurance companies that are refusing to pay death claims because they consider it some kind of a suicide clause. They said those people voluntarily accepted an unapproved experimental vaccine. So that's their problem, not ours. Of course, you all know, you know, I'm no fan of insurance companies, and anybody, I don't think anybody is either. They don't want to pay anything, even a legitimate claim. But even they're starting to back off on their payments now.
We're hearing that 30, maybe 40% of people could be on prescription drugs for their mental health. Are there other options for people to improve their mental health?
Yes, there is another option, and that's physical fitness. Physical fitness. And that's what I want to, that's what I want to talk about right now, guys. That, that, you know, some of you guys that have heard me over and over and over again, you know that this has always been the, you know, my number one investment. Even though I'm in the money business, I love to make money, but I love to take care of my health even more. But, you know, neglecting your physical health is the fastest way to ruin your mental health. The fastest way. So, which makes it even harder to take care of your physical health. So, all you guys, I want you guys to get started with some kind of physical program and start small. Don't have some major goal. Like, if you have 50 pounds to lose, I don't want you to say, I need to lose 50 pounds in the next year. That's a big goal. I'd rather have you start in the next month, I'm going to lose 5 pounds. And after that, you say, wow, I did that. Because that's achievable. It's not overwhelming. The next 5 months, I'm going to lose another 5 pounds or 4 pounds. So start slowly. And it's the same with an exercise program. When you go to the gym, I'm not going to give you, you know, 10 or 15 exercises to do. I'm going to give you 4 or 3. And I'm going to say, I want you to do these 3 exercises 3 times a week. But, Bob, that's only going to take me 20 minutes a day. Exactly. I want you to develop a habit where you end up, you keep going to the gym, and all of a sudden you go, wow, I feel so much better. You know, I'm going to do 4 sets of this. Or I'm going to do 5. But so you got to think small, guys. Don't think big, you know. You know, like you say, I want to make $1 million. I'm going to make $1 million. That's, you know, starting from scratch. That's huge. You know what I said when I was a kid? I'm going to make $10,000, $5,000, then $10,000, then $20,000, you know. And it just that little by little by little, my net worth kept going up where I developed a habit. But with respect to health and money, if you lose money, you can always find a way to make it back. Your business goes bust. You can start another one. Hey, I've had plenty of businesses that have failed. But you only have one body, guy. One. Replacement parts are never as good as the original. I have people my age, you know, they have false hips. Their knees are shot. Now they can't even throw a baseball because they get a tweak in their neck. So that you can put artificial knees and artificial shoulders in, they're never as good as the original. So some parts of your body just can't be replaced. So take care of it, you guys. Take care of your body. Take care of it. That should be your highest priority. Because if you let your body go, you're done. You're done.
Bob, would you consider that our health and fitness tip and life lesson for this show?
What do you think, Jim?
I think being as fit as you can is a great goal, and it does help you mentally. I've been ill the last 2 weeks, and not being able to swim every day is driving me up the wall.
Absolutely. And I'm in the same boat as you are. Everybody, I confess to my friend Jim Goddard that I've had my first cold in 5 years. 5 years. And I have to be honest with you. That was a good run because I take zinc, I take quercetin and vitamin C, and I exercise like a maniac and run hills like a maniac and watch my daughter and watch my diet. But even then, I got a cold, and it has, just like Jim, I feel terrible. I haven't been at the gym. I haven't run hills. I'm almost 100% back right now, so I'm going to start that. But I just can't wait to get back. And anybody that starts going to the gym, and I'll finish with this, and you don't feel like it, just ask yourself, is this a good decision I'm making not to go to the gym? Ask yourself objectively. And the answer is going to be no. So get your effing butt to the gym and force yourself to go to the gym. It's all discipline, guys. It's all pure discipline. But I promise you, I guarantee you, if you listen to my message and take it to heart, you will thank me for the rest of your life.
Bob, thank you so much for chatting with us. And just before we go, how can people find out more about your newsletter and book?
Sure. You can go to my website, which is realestatetiming.com, just like it sounds. Three easy words with no dots or dashes. You can order my book, Timing the Real Estate Market, that gives you the five key indicators to follow. You can get my newsletter, which many of my followers, my new followers from House Street have done. They subscribe to my timing letter. And so you can be more informed than the huge majority of people. And so, sure, you can do that.
Bob, thank you again.
Thanks, Jim. You take care. Talk to you in a month.
My guest has been Robert Campbell. He was speaking to us from San Diego.
And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Rick Ackerman, and Robert Campbell. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@housestreet.com. Now, stand by for a company showcase update from American Manganese CEO and President Larry Ray. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen. Welcome to Company Showcase, an advertising feature on HowStreet.com.
I'm Jim Goddard. I'm speaking with Larry Ray, CEO and President of American Manganese. Welcome back to the show, Larry.
Glad to be on here, Jim.
Larry, two news releases came out of your office this week. What did we learn?
Well, March 29th, we came out with a press release regarding our Rocher de Boule high-grade copper gold property. And one of the big items in it was the fact that we received the drill permits for drilling this summer. And that's getting to be quite an accomplishment. There's a lot of companies that are held up trying to get permits and have been for the last year or two. And so it's not a simple thing to get, especially here in B.C. So anyway, we're set to go and drill that property, and we reported also the significant rare earth values on the Rocher de Boule project, and those significant rare earth values are very high anonymous values. I mean, in over 1,000 parts per billion, or per million, I should say. And, it gives us another eyeball on what the potential of that project would be. Certainly we know rare earths are front and center, even above the battery metals production, that the rare earths are also front and center when it comes to all the elements. So, we're happy to have that. It gives us a potential possibility of not only finding high-grade copper and gold, but also to, then I should mention cobalt in there as well and nickel. But it also gives the potential for rare earths and, like neodymium, and that's for these very powerful magnets. And it's also in very much demand in the automobile industry totally, and also in the electric vehicles. So, it puts us in another position. I mean, we don't know what's going to be there until it's drilled, but it's given us some wonderful targets. And what I like to see when I'm looking at the geological reports is I like to see coincidental anomalies. For example, coincidental would mean that you have a IP, which is induced polarization, or a geophysical anomaly that lines up with a geochemical anomaly, so that you've got the two are coincident with each other. And usually you'll have, as well as that, you'll have geological coincidence. And any ore body that any company I've had that's been under discovery has had these things. So I like to see that. It gives us a much better shot at finding something. And so I couldn't be happier than I am right now when it comes to the negotiable property. I know a lot of people say, well, geez, you're diverting your attention from the recycling. Well, that's not true. We're not diverting our attention. You know, I used to have anywhere up to six companies, usually around four, and that were in the mining industry, and you know, we could run those programs with the same skeleton crew we have right now, aside from the consultants that'd be on the job. And mining is a different aspect of it. The recycling is a different aspect of it. So, you know, we just have another iron in the fire. But look at it that way. I mean, who's going to throw out the baby with the bathwater? So, you know, here we go. We got stuff happening on Rocher de Boule. And our second press release was the one regarding Biden's announcement the other day that we put out today. And it's to do with the battery materials and the fact that he mentions that recycling is in there, on getting some of these Defense Production Act authorizations to for funding tools for the battery grade lithium, cobalt, nickel, manganese, and salt and graphite. Now, the what you can say about that is that suddenly recycling has become one of the ways to mine batteries, and you know, I'm using that word mine because most of this material is mined at one point or another, and it is just another process that we have that's really mining the lithium-ion batteries. And but the understanding of the DPA authorities, the action that's carried out by Biden is can use the force of the U.S. federal law, opens up funding authorities ranging from federal loans and loan guarantees to grant financing production facilities. So that's another big area for us. I'm not saying that we've got that. Of course, it just came out. But, you know, we certainly should be standing in line for a grant like that. So it's been an interesting week. Jim, we've come up with two good releases. Of course, the stock didn't do much, as most of our releases do. It usually goes down, but it didn't go down today, so that's a plus. So it's, you know, I feel really good about everything. I feel good about my health. I'm feeling good about the health of the company. I'm feeling good about the progress that's being made, and you know, I think that we have a real good shot at cornering a few of these things. You know, everybody was concerned that the Department of Defense was no longer going to employ us to test their material at Wendon. But I think that's just a hiccup in the phase. I think that eventually they'll have to come back to us. So I'm not worried about it. You know, so other people worry about things like, gee whiz, you know, we gotta lobby hard, we gotta do this, we gotta do that, we gotta do this, we gotta do that. Hey, we got a process that works, and we're proud to stand behind it, and they'll come banging on our door sooner or later. So we'll just continue on with the recycling process, and now with a drilling program going up at Rocher de Boule. Now, I know that, again, people, especially the detractors of the on the company side, like to point out that, oh, yeah, you know, now they're doing this because that's not working. Well, that's not the truth. The truth of the matter is that our recycling progress has never taken a backward step. And but we want to make sure that the forward step is in a solid position to land on concrete, not on quicksand. So We want to have this process as much de-risked as we can when we get the recycling plant up and running. And that's being worked on a steady basis. But the demonstration recycling plant is in the works, and we're going to be moving ahead with it. So anyway, I'm not going to apologize about my voice today. I think I'm coming through that phase, and here we are. I'm feeling energetic, and I'm feeling very optimistic about the progress of the company, and I can't be complaining too much about the fact that we didn't go up, but we didn't go down, and that's the thing in this bear market that we're in. It's a bear bull, and it's a different kind of a market than I have experienced before. It's more like the experience back in the 70s of the market where it was static. Nothing went up, nothing went down, and until it was ready to go, and it finally did go, and it went up into a big bull market. So, maybe that's what's happening here. I don't know how the effect of printing money and wars and everything else is going to have on it, but it certainly has a temporary effect on the market. It has a temporary effect on the bullish effect on commodities, and even oil and gas, is bullish now with the war with the Ukraine and Russia. So, it's just a lot of things to factor in. But the overall picture, as I see it, is the companies that have the goods will go ahead. And we want to make sure that we're in that category. So we have proven to this time that we have the goods. So a little more work will show we can do it on a continuous basis. So I wish everybody a great weekend. I'm looking forward to it. It's one time the markets are closed. You're not, pushed around emotionally about the market. So it's a time to rest up and move ahead. So have a good weekend, everybody. And that's kind of the end of my podcast.
Larry, where are you traded, and how can people get more information about American Manganese?
Well, we're traded on the Toronto Venture Exchange under the symbol AMY. We're traded on the QB board under the symbol AMYZF. And just to mention on that, people want me to go on the NASDAQ. I know there's requirements that we don't meet at this point. But just to let you know that when we entered into the NASDAQ market in 87, we became the second highest gainer that year after the crash in October. And I'm proud of that little ability that we had. We were second highest. I think there was a 1,000 or so NASDAQ stocks at that time. So we didn't quite make the highest, but second is pretty good as far as I'm concerned. And so that was on the NASDAQ board, and we're also traded in the Frankfurt Exchange under the symbol 2AM, and I expect that exchange will start to get active here sooner than later because we have a lot of European shareholders. And I don't know where they trade. They may trade in Vancouver. They may trade on the QB board. But not a lot of trading goes on in the Frankfurt Exchange. Now, you can find more information about us on our website, AmericanManganeseInc.com. We're very transparent about everything that we do. We not only have transparency of news, we have a weekly podcast, which has been interrupted a couple times this year, but I don't expect to see any further interruptions, and I know that a lot of people look forward to listening to the podcast, and I think we're in for a good time in the market, guys, as simple as that. So if you're looking for information on the company, we've already mentioned the website, the You can phone the company at 778-574-4444, or you can email me at lreaugh@amymn.com.
Larry, thank you so much for the update.
You're welcome, Jim.
We've been speaking with Larry Ray, CEO and President of American Manganese. I'm Jim Goddard. Our conversation took place on April 1st.
Comments made on Company Showcase are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at HowStreet.com. Company Showcase is a production of How Street Media Incorporated.